I have to take a 27,000-foot drop. And you know you're going to pass out because you have no oxygen up there at that time. And in those days, you had to just take free fall. You don't open up the parachute. And we fell for 25,000 feet. Finally, we came to and opened up our parachute. We were coming down so quickly. I broke my 6 ribs. I fractured 2 ankles. I broke an arm and split my head open.
An attention-holding personal story from World War II on this edition of Come Receive the Light, and a celebration for a church in Trenton, New Jersey, where a lot of changes have occurred since they opened their doors 100 years ago.
Yes, Trenton today is a shadow of its former self in terms of economy, and the demographics of the community have changed significantly. But of course, with that, there are new opportunities that can be undertaken. And so in our parish here, we're really trying to focus on those opportunities now and to make sure that we're capitalizing as a parish on doing the work of the gospel here in Trenton.
And welcome to another weekly edition of the broadcast outreach of the Orthodox Christian Network called Come Receive the Light. Our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos, and I'm Mike Trout. If you're hearing us on a local radio station, we're also on the web at myocn.net. And if you're listening to us on the web, perhaps your local parish would like to bring this broadcast to a local station. More information about that is on our website, again, myocn.net. Our purpose as a ministry is to present the truths of the Bible through the lens of the Orthodox Christian faith. We tackle a variety of subjects each week and have been doing this over 20 years now. For many things, I know that's not a long time, but it seems like a long time to us. And you can join with us financially if you're looking for a way to expand your Christian witness. Please consider partnering with the Orthodox Christian Network. Again, the website myocn.net. More details are there. And if you just happened by the broadcast on the radio dial, I encourage you to stay tuned and to investigate more on our website. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Well, in our 20 years on the air, we've gone through a few changes and have made adjustments to become more effective. I've mentioned before one of my favorite quotes, "Change is the way the future enters our lives." And that's certainly the way one Orthodox church in Trenton, New Jersey has approached the changes in their community and their ministry for over 100 years. Father Chris gets the details from our first guest, Reverend John Diamantis of St. Vladimir Orthodox Christian Church.
Welcome, Father John.
Thank you very much, Father Christopher. It's a joy to be with you and to speak with you today.
First, I'd like to congratulate you on the parish celebrating its 100th anniversary. That's certainly a long time. Let's go back a little bit. Can we go back 100 years and talk about the Russian immigrants at that point?
We can certainly do our best, Father.
All right.
The Russian immigration parallels so many of the other immigrant groups that came to this nation, coming for the same reasons, many of them around the same time. And so we found that 100 years ago, the Russians who came here from Russia proper and Carpatho Russia and Galicia came here looking just for what they thought would be a better life, prosperity, the hope of jobs, and of course came in waves as families and communities and settled here in the eastern part of the United States and making their way into Trenton little by little. And so that's really the cultural roots of this parish are Russian.
When the folks came over from Russia, was there a particular type of employment that they sought? Where did they find themselves gravitating to?
Many of them, of course, not just in this area, but in the greater northeastern area, ended up working in coal mines and factories in general. The industrial opportunities here were quite extensive at that time. And that was something that they were able to do very easily and to gravitate toward. And Trenton, of course, has a very rich history of being an industrial city and a manufacturing city and one that would export to nations around the world. And there's even a sign on one of our bridges in Trenton that says, "Trenton makes, the world takes." And so that really was true at that time.
No, that's something. I mean, these are folks that came with nothing. I mean, we have people today who have all the conveniences and every type of opportunity in their hands, and they can't even tie their shoes. And these folks came over with literally nothing. I mean, let's talk about that. What are the challenges that they face at that time?
Well, naturally, I mean, the linguistic challenge coming to a country and being here no longer surrounded just by their own people and their own culture, but all of a sudden being integrated into a culture of people from a variety of backgrounds, certainly the linguistic challenge was present. And also, again, financially, working in these jobs, they were not very high-paying jobs or prestigious, of course. These were, you know, low-paying, labor-intensive positions that many of these people were taking up just to make ends meet. And so it was very difficult for them, I can only imagine, to be at that time in this country. And we have to remember also that 1915 and then going into the early 20s, for us here, entered into the time of the Great Depression as well. So it was a particularly difficult time for all of those reasons.
All right, that's a good framing. Let's look at Orthodox Christians in Trenton in the early 1900s. I mean, are there any records of how many Christians were there? How many Orthodox Christians were there?
Of course, early on, as people were coming over, the community was very small. This parish, being founded in 1915, was started by just about 30 people. And so those 30 people worked very, very diligently, even using their own hands to save money to dig the foundation of the church at the time, scraping pennies together, sometimes literally, and doing everything in their power to make this community what it could be. And of course, over time, we see that immigration to this area continued to occur. The biggest part of that was in the early 1900s, 1910 to 1920 or 1930. And so that's when we see the largest influx of Russians coming over. So at that time, this community was quite small.
Okay. Now, Trenton has changed a lot. Economy, employment, commerce. It wasn't Trenton today was not Trenton then, as you mentioned before, right?
Yes, Trenton today is a shadow of its former self in terms of economy, and the demographics of the community have changed significantly. So what was at one time a very European-looking town, lots of Russians and Italians and Poles and Irish, is today primarily African-American and Hispanic. And it's very interesting as you drive through the town or walk through the town that you would still see the remnants of yesteryear with, you know, cultural clubs or even the churches in town, which in many cases are just very lightly attended or poorly attended. But of course, with that, there are new opportunities and new adventures that can be undertaken. And so in our parish here, we're really trying to focus on those opportunities now and to make sure that we're capitalizing as a parish on doing the work of the gospel here in Trenton.
Okay, so we're talking about a community that's 100 years old. We're talking about a thriving beginning, a difficult beginning, because the immigrants had come over from difficult circumstances in Russia. They find themselves in Trenton. They go into basic labor-type situations where they can function, not even knowing the language. That's then, and this is now. So let's talk about, you said the whole neighborhood has changed, Trenton has changed. What type of outreach do you do now in this local community?
I'm so glad you asked that, Father. Thank you. One of the real emphases for our parish, since I've been here for the last 2 years, has really been to focus on serving the community in any way that we can and educating our people about how to be involved in service, even with our church school. So, for instance, with our church school program, it's an expectation now that they are involved with a community service project 4 times a year, 2 within the parish, but 2 to do outreach to the community. So, for instance, doing a talent show at a nursing home or just spending time with residents or writing cards or something like this exterior to the walls of our parish. And every month, our parish as a whole undertakes a service project. So we'll do things like collect food for a food pantry that we've begun here in the parish, or collect clothing to donate to a local organization that serves those in need. And just last month, we had a rather creative idea, I thought, that we would hold a baby shower for local mothers in need and donate those gifts to a local organization that serves those mothers, and to have somebody from that organization come and speak to our parish about what they do. And there was a great response from our community about that, a lot of interest in being even more involved. So I was very proud of our people for that and very grateful for that opportunity. And we're always looking for more things to do. But really, we're trying to have a very local emphasis on community service and really trying to engender that gospel commandment within our community, and to have our people understand that and to really embrace it. And so far, little by little, glory to God, it's coming along very nicely.
That's wonderful, Father. We thank you for being with us. We wish you congratulations and another 100 years of strength and Orthodox witness in Trenton.
Thank you so much, Father. I very much appreciate it.
If you'd like to learn more about the work in Trenton, New Jersey, and perhaps talk with Father John Diamantis, go to the church's website at saintvladimir.org. Saint is spelled out S-A-I-N-T, and then Vladimir, V-L-A-D-I-M-I-R.org. On their homepage, they have a stunning panoramic view of the inside of their 100-year-old church. That's saintvladimir.org. You're listening to Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network. We're on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. I'm Mike Trout, and our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos. And now with our feature conversation on this Independence Day weekend in the U.S., here again is Father Chris.
Surviving a B-17 bailout in 1944 over France, Airman John Katsaris was captured by the Gestapo and eventually rescued by the French underground. He's here to tell us about his personal account and his book describing the terror. He's a true hero. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Seth.
Let me ask you this question. How old were you when you signed up to fight in World War II?
I was 18 years old. I joined the Naval Air Cadet Program at the age of 18, 2 days after Pearl Harbor.
How'd your parents feel about that?
Well, it was either going to service as a... well, let's put it this way. As soon as Pearl Harbor happened, there was 27 of us from a Haverhill High School that went down the very next day to join the Naval Air Cadet Program.
Amazing. That's amazing.
And they told us to come back the next day because they were overwhelmed.
They were overwhelmed.
So your parents knew that the younger men... I had three brothers, and we were all in the service. Mm-hmm. None of them were drafted. We all joined. Mm-hmm. My older brother joined first. I joined right along with him. My brother George, who was the mayor of Haverhill, joined. My brother Sot was a solderist. He was the principal of Haverhill High School. And he joined up in the Air Force, and my other two brothers were in the U.S. Army.
An incredible generation. Tell us happened after you bailed out. After you bailed out of the plane over France, talk to us about that experience.
Well, the most important thing is telling you what happened. Why did this happen?
Okay.
It happened because when we were flying to Frankfurt, Germany, the weather was so bad, we were bouncing all over the sky, and one plane above us almost hit us. We went into a dive, and by the time we get back up to 30,000 feet, we'd couldn't see another plane in sight, and we went into the target area. Nobody was there but us. We were in there alone. The others were ordered to go to different cities. And when we got into Frankfurt, the weather opened up, and we bombed the target. We lost two engines there, and we fought the German Air Force all the way back to Reims, France, and they killed four men aboard the ship. And we were in a situation where we had to help one another out. The plane caught fire, and we were ordered to bail out. At that moment, we had trouble with the ball tour operator. We were stuck in a ball tour because he had a large gearbox. It was loaded with empty shells, and he couldn't get out. And the only two men in the plane at that time was a radio man and myself. And we were over there plucking these shells out of the gearbox so he could get out. We finally got him out, and he bailed out. And we both got shot again, and both got shot in the right arm. And neither one could put a parachute on. So we had to clip the parachute on each other's person. Now you have to take a 27,000-foot drop. And you know you have to pass out because you have no oxygen up there at that time.
Right.
And we fell for 25,000 feet. Finally, we came to and opened up our parachute. We were coming down so quickly, I broke my 6 ribs, and I fractured 2 ankles. I broke an arm and split my head open.
My goodness.
And I'm lying down on the ground, and 2 German planes came over and gave my position away to the Gestapo, who came in, picked me up, and they brought me down to the local, it was a big farm, actually. And what they did, they brought me to the home of that farm, and they put me out. They laid me in the floor of of their dining room, and I was there for 7 days. They thought that I was going to die. They questioned me, and I wouldn't give them any answers. Finally, they brought a doctor, and they wanted to cut my arm off, and I wouldn't let them do it. And when they came back the second day, and I told them I didn't want them done, they left me for dead. So I gave my Greek prayers, and I was hopeful of some help coming to my way. Either that, or I was going to die right then and then. So I made up my mind what was going to happen. But the 7th day, 3 men walked in with pistols, and as they came in, one came up to me and he put his finger to his mouth, and I realized it must be the French resistance. That the other 2 men went into the back room and they shot the 2 guards that were guarding me. They took me to put me in their car and drove me down to a clinic, which is right behind the Reims Cathedral in Reims, France. And the clinic is still there, and there's a Jew French doctor that was hiding in the cellar from the Nazis with a Star of David on his chest. And he came upstairs and he said, "My name is Dr. Levy, and I'll do what I can to help you." And he operated that morning and ran out of ether. They got more ether, and that afternoon they operated again, ran out of ether again. Now, this is the 8th day, and my arm had caught gangrene badly. And the doctor said, "If I don't get some more ether, this man's going to lose his arm." So the resistance said, "You're too tired to operate again, but tomorrow morning we'll give you all the ether you want." So they stole the ether out of our hospital in Reims and brought it to the doctor. He operated, and I woke up, my arm was in a cast. And that was the last time I ever saw that doctor. He went into hiding. Well, to get to the point that night when I was recovering, I hadn't had any water in over 8 days, and I was dehydrated. So I rang the bell for water, and the nurse downstairs came up, and she says, "VP Dalle." Thank God I took a couple of years of French classes in high school. So I understood what she was saying. That means that we got to get you out of here. There's a lot of problems. So she told me that there was a lady downstairs that answered the phone, that buzzer, and she was a plant by the Germans, and she was calling the authorities and let them know that nobody's supposed to be in that room. So they dressed me up in my bloody coverall, put me out in the street, and I'm laying there on Saturday afternoon, and the German soldiers are walking by. They probably thought I was a drunk. And about 15 minutes later, a couple came by, picked me up, and brought me to a French cavalry headquarters for World War I. And they shoved me upstairs and put me in jail. And in the jail, there was a bed. And I stayed there that night. Next morning, a fellow walked in dressed up as a cavalry officer and demanded to know who I was. And I had given only my name, rank, and serial number because I thought by this time the Germans had me. And what had happened, to make a long story short, a woman came in and talked to me. And she said, "I know all about you because I know the 3 men that saved your life. And these fellows are going to shoot you tomorrow morning because they don't trust you. They think you're German." I said, "Why do they think I'm German?" He said, "Because instead of saying yes, you're saying ja." And ja is a word for German, in German for yes. So you have to be careful what you say.
What you said. And that was in 1944, correct?
March 20th, 1944, the day I got shot down.
Goodness gracious, what a story. Tell us about Code Burgundy, the long escape.
Well, what happened?
What'd you write?
After I went in that place and my three men came and got me out, and they brought me to a one of the fellows that came in and put his finger to his mouth, took me to his home, mm-hmm. about 14 kilometers from Reims, France, and he had a bakery. And also he had a lot of chickens, and I started eating pretty good because I had eggs and chicken, and his bread was just wonderful. And it wasn't long that I got back my health, and I went to work for the French Resistance. And we were doing a lot of things against the Germans by gathering supplies that the British were dropping to us. And eventually what happened, the British intelligence found out about me, and they approached me to work with them as well. So they gave me the code word named Burgundy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't known by Jean Casares. I was just known by Burgundy to the British. What happened is that this fellow had a cache of guns and ammunition and bombs and time bombs and so forth that he hid underneath the cellar of his chicken coop. And it was a 10-by-10 room loaded with all this stuff. For instance, one day we found an American fighter, a P-51 fighter, and it was in intact, perfect condition. And the pilot just abandoned it. We didn't know why. And we had to take care of it. We had to blow it up. And he went down to the cellar, got his time bomb. He befriended the guard on the P-51, and he was allowed to go in the pilot's compartment, put it under the seat of the pilot's seat, and an hour later blew up.
Hmm.
We did so many things that the Germans knew who I was. They had my dog tags, and they figured it out that I was working with them, so they put a $10,000 reward on me. And after a few days, the Gestapo walked into the house, and the lady of the house and I were captured again. They brought us down to the Gestapo headquarters in Reims, France, and they started a Smith McSell front, and they tortured the poor lady. And all they did with me, they beat me up a little, but it'll take me another half hour, an hour to explain how I escaped the second time, but it had to be with the French chief police of Reims, the British intelligence, and the French resistance combined. They had to get me out again because by this time, I had known so many people. I knew where their headquarters were. I knew the names of the mm-hmm. people. And so they had to get me out. They didn't, you know, if I ever got captured, they probably would have, they figured I might give their names up, and it would have been a disaster in
okay.
the Reims area.
Tell us a little bit, John, about the book. We're almost at our end of our time together, but tell us a little bit about this book that you've put together. I know it's illustrated as well.
Well, it took me 20 years to research it, and I went back and forth to France several times and went to see all my friends that helped me. I got all their names properly, and I figured I'd write a narrative and give it to my grandchildren someday.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a German, a Greek colonel that comes to our church, and he offered to be my editor. So we proceeded to write this together. And all of a sudden, the book got bigger and bigger, and I had pictures that I had taken during World War II, and I put mm-hmm. them, I started putting them into the picture, and then it became a book rather than a narrative.
I got
and,
you.
So I printed the book, and now the British, the American intelligence has me flying all over the country talking.
That's amazing.
I gave my 274th presentation yesterday.
Wow, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, look, for those of you who are listening, to this, the book is available in our Amazon store, and the link will be on our website connected to this interview at it'll be www.johncatsaros.com. Great to talk with you, John. Thank you so much, sir.
Very good. Thank you very much for calling, and have a good day.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
The book title again is Code Burgundy, The Long Escape. And when you order it through our bookstore at myocn.net, a portion of the purchase price comes back to us in the form of a donation from Amazon. This is a broadcast outreach of the Orthodox Christian Network called Come Receive the Light. Next week, we continue our theme of religious freedom by looking at the historical roots of Orthodox colonization of the southern tip of America, spearheaded by Great Britain.
This was a 3-year planning process from 1764 to 1768 when they finally left in April 1768. They were working on this for quite a while. So it's intricate, and it's amazing how Spain and Britain and the Turks and the Greeks and the church were all involved with it.
That's next week at this same time on Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network.